Welcome to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Before we get to the Sean Tully and Zach Blair episode, just a reminder to sign up for our promotion with Cricket Shirts, Adel Golf, and the Congress Hotel. Visit our Twitter page, Instagram, or newsletter to enter for your chance to win a trip to Austin for the Dell Match Play Championship. I went to this tournament last year. It was an awesome event, and Austin is one of my favorite cities in the whole world. The prize package includes tickets to the tournament, a full bag of clubs from Austin Basie Dell, 2 nights at the South Congress Hotel, a $500 gift certificate to Cricket Shirts, and airfare to Austin. Now, without further ado, here's Sean Tully and Zach Blair.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie. I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today we are joined by Zach Blair, podcast regular, and then the superintendent at the Meadow Club, noted golf historian, and the godfather of wit, Sean Tully. Sean, welcome on.
Thank you.
I feel like I owe you royalties, you know, width and angles. It's kind of a ripoff from the man that's, you know, been preaching width for years. How's it feel to have an era where width is becoming almost embraced?
It's been great to see. It's taken a long time watching all the tournament golf that we see on TV where all the bunkers are lost in the rough. I feel like it feels really good to see that. We need that in the game today for sure for golf to be enjoyable. For all levels of play.
Yeah, Zach and I just finished playing up here at Meadow Club, Alistair McKenzie's first design. Lots of width. Zach, what'd you think?
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to play up here a couple of times. Played here in college about every year I was at BYU, so it's always fun to come back. So I knew we had to definitely hit this spot up on the Blair Wish Project San Francisco voyage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been a good one. We've hit up a bunch of different golf courses, but a few Alistair McKenzie's. Sean, was it when you got this job in 2000 that you really became enamored with McKenzie, or did it start before then?
It definitely started before then. Knowing what he was able to do and seeing pictures at that time, living in Wisconsin and not being out here, just seeing the golf courses and knowing what I was seeing and wanting to embrace that a little bit more, had to come out to California to see it though.
Mm-hmm. That's how did you get into golf? Like being from Wisconsin and
yeah, this is my first job in high school. My brother, who's a superintendent in Chicago, was supposed to go interview for a job, and woke up that morning and was like, I'm not going in. And for some reason I said, I'm going in. So I went in to interview for the job, and the superintendent was quite confused when I said my name was Sean Tully and not Ryan Tully. But I'm very thankful that he didn't want to go to work that day or go to his interview. And, you know, the same golf course that my dad worked at, and the superintendent knew my dad. So I think he was going to hire us either way. But it's
he just got a different Tully.
Yeah. Yeah.
What course was that at?
Delbrook in Delvin, Wisconsin. It's an old Fowles brother, one of the Fowles brothers. I haven't had a chance to figure that one out, but one degree of separation from Old Tom Morris, which kind of got me started.
Mm-hmm. So that you have this, you know, directory of historical findings and all the stuff. As a kid, were you really into history, and did it just naturally lend itself into golf?
Yes. I've always, you know, I don't read fiction. I'm a nonfiction guy, so I like the facts. And my dad, just being in the game, he was a really good golfer, qualified for the Greater Milwaukee Open as an amateur. And just his love of the game, my grandfather's love of the game, it keeps me close to both of those of my family in the game, just being good on the golf course.
Parents in the game. That's like you, Z.
Yeah, it's always nice to have, you know, you get to spend time with them, and then it just kind of, like Tolley said, it kind of keeps you close to them. So it's cool. It's definitely a neat sport that way.
So, Sean, you've got a lot of different things from a historical, and you found a bunch of things. What's like the coolest piece of golf history or artifact or information that you've uncovered in your time?
That's a good question. Probably just learning more about the evolution of golf and how good or how not so good some of the early stuff was. Pebble Beach, when it first opened, it kind of got lambasted to some degree. And Herbert Fowler was brought in almost within a year of the course opening, and he drew up plans. And finding his plans and his description of the golf course and his changes was pretty amazing to find. That, when I came across the information about Billy Bell doing some of the bunker work at San Francisco Golf Club, was pretty amazing. And getting back to width, I am a fan of width and fairways. And I found an article from, I think, 1934, where it finally spelled out what the width was in golf at that time frame, with the low end being 40 yards and the high end being 60. I think we have a lot to learn still in golf on what constitutes good golf. And it doesn't have to be off the tee to be challenging. And, you know, it's about angles and having the opportunity to find that. And, we don't need 22-yard fairways.
So with the modern game, the ball goes further, sometimes more offline. Do you think width is about the same, or should it be wider to accommodate for the longer distances people are hitting it?
I'm always going to say more width is better. It can be challenging. I mean, I can already say I don't hit the ball very far, but if you hit the ball online and where you need to hit it, then you're in a good place. And if you miss hit your shot or have some factors that you haven't factored into your shot, and you're going to be more offline, further offline than you need to be, and find new and different challenges, hopefully.
Yeah, we played, Zach and I played a golf course today that isn't known by many and doesn't have a lot of width. Northwood. A 9-hole McKenzie golf course in Del Monte, or is it Del Rio?
Monte Rio.
It's a cool little town. Is that one of the, you know, golf's biggest kind of tragedies and where it is right now compared to what it could be?
Well, Sharp Park is always the easy go-to for that. You know, the course has suffered with a lot of the river, the Russian River, going over its banks quite a few times. I think the 20 feet over the eighth green. So it gets, when the river goes over there, it's over. And they've, you know, Ed Bale, the superintendent there, he's been there for a number of years. He could tell you how many times he's had to rebuild that green there and a couple of the other holes. So we're lucky to even have the course with that much water.
It's such a cool place. It's, in this little town, and you just drive up and you never would expect it. What got McKenzie up there to do that project?
Well, the story that I understand it is John or Jack Neville, a noted amateur player, had his hand in design, was the one that introduced Hunter and McKenzie to the property. There's been quite a few people have done research, and we still have not found. There's some people that feel there's a connection to the Bohemian Club, which is right there as well. So far, that's the story that we're sticking with at the moment. But we haven't found anything that really is cut and dry.
You know, I think that place has like a sneaky more width than we're giving it credit for, though. Because like we didn't hit one tree out there the entire day, realistically.
I hit one.
But I think the trees are so massive that it just looks extremely tight.
There's that visual.
Yeah.
Especially watching the drone footage you guys did today. It just makes it look even tighter. But I also saw you guys hit the ball today, and the trees weren't going to be an issue no matter what. You guys were playing really good.
I guess that is almost a thing with scale. It goes to scale. How important is it to have matching scale?
It's really important. I mean, you know, we have fairly good scale here with our bunkers. You know, they aren't super big out here, but they fit and they feel good with the contours that we have. You know, another good example would be San Francisco Golf Club. You know, the scale of that property is so huge. And you have some of the bunkers on three, the one that runs short right off your tee shot is a great bunker. And it ties in with the bunkers behind it. A lot of it is scale, and you don't need big bunkers if you layer your bunkers. And we talked about that quite a few times with our bunkers out here, how McKenzie used strategic bunkering to move you around the golf course. And, you know, we have some of them lost in trees. You know, the tee shot on number two is one that it would be a good example. And then your second shot into number four here at Meadow Club, where you're looking and you have the bunkers stacked up behind the green from, you know, four green, five green, two green, and even 14 if you stand in the right spot.
I noticed that with Golden Age Architects, they layered greens on top of each other so well, but then those bunkers, and they catch your eye. And sometimes, you know, we live in this day and age of technology where visual deception's a bit lost because we play with rangefinders. We always know what the exact yardage is, and we can shoot bunkers, but was McKenzie the greatest, in your opinion, at layering and stacking bunkers on and making, you know, deceiving the eye?
Well, I would say yes. Obviously, given his background with camouflage and trying to, he is challenging your eye in a lot of ways, more so than, you know, other architects were privy to. The challenge, you know, we talk about yardages, and you, if you hit a tee shot, it's 175 yards and the bunker's at 160. But we don't like bunkers by nature. We don't want to be in them. So no matter how many few bunkers or how many more bunkers are in the background, your mind may know the yardage, but it still is looking at those bunkers going, I don't like the bunkers, I don't like the bunkers. So it's a mind game. He's playing with your mind and just trying to make it look harder than it actually is.
You guys have been working with Mike DeVries since 1999. You got here in 2000. It's been, you know, you've kind of been chipping away at it a lot. And obviously, a lot of clubs in America don't necessarily have the financial resources to do full-blown restorations right out of the gate, or even member buy-in to do them. What advice do you have for a club that might be trying to start the restoration and really improvement process? Like,
first of all, it's been really great to work with Mike. His vision and understanding of what we have here has really helped push this program, our restoration program, along. To get to your question, what has really worked for us is figuring out which hole, which is our fifth hole here, has the most documentation, and being able to draw from the pictures and state the historical nature of that hole. It's a copy of the Eden hole from St. Andrews, and the importance of it and the scale and scope of the design, and trying to get back to that. And we did it over, you know, try to gain the members' trust of those that may not understand what we're trying to do. Some of that was with tree removal, which can be hard. I mean, there's, you know, when most of our members joined here, there was the course had become more of a parkland course, and had lost that meadow definition that is in the name of the club. So for some of them, it's been pretty hard to see our trees come down, but it's at the same time, it's been pretty amazing to see and be able to see more of the golf course and understand the design and the thoughts that went into it. But, you know, just trying to figure out where you can best make your case and have the history work in your favor to tell the story and make the work that you're doing work for you. And there's different ways to do the work. And when we first started our restoration, the process was trying to figure out what would work. An intern that was working for Mike at the time, Mark Thawley, who now works with Kyle Phillips, did a dissertation at Arizona on how to best do a restoration. So he went around the country and interviewed and you know, came up with the program that we ended up going with was doing a couple holes each year for the minimal impact. Our members love playing Meadow Club, and you know, we were not going to shut the course down for anything. They love this course, as they should. And the program went over a 5-year period, 6-year period, you know, with minimal impact, and the turnaround was pretty quick. By the time we got to the end, the last year, our process was really good.
Zach, you played this course a couple times in college. How have you noticed the change over the years?
When I was in school, some of the stuff was already done. You know, some of the big changes, like 15 and 13, they'd kind of taken down the trees and they'd done a lot of the bunker work. I mean, most of it, honestly. Now, you know, they're really working on the aprons kind of around the green, kind of promoting that ground game and everything. And I mean, it's even better than, you know, when I played it 4 or 5 years ago. So it's always fun to come back.
It's cool to see walking through your clubhouse. There's so many old photos, and I think you're lucky in that they have you that finds all this stuff, but also that there's so much documentation available, because you see it was a meadow. I mean, there's no trees, there's nothing, and there's all of a sudden all these angles and different options to play. Like, you know, today I played with a hickory driver, which was unbelievable. I was all of a sudden hitting long irons in, but like on some holes I was playing way right, and I played into another fairway to set up an angle because I knew I was going to have like a 4-iron and I needed to get an open way in. And you know, you're getting so close to being where you need to be, but there's just still a few more trees to go. I imagine working somewhere where you know the ones you want them to go, like coming in and seeing them every day, like that's got to get just frustrating.
There is some frustration there. But at the end of the day, you know, as frustrated as you know, being a historian, it's really hard to not feel that way and knowing how good the golf course was. It's just my job to educate the golfers as best I can to get them to understand what we're trying to do from an agronomic standpoint, and then, you know, trying to give them the best product, the best golf course they can. In some ways, we have some responsibility to honoring McKenzie and his work, well, in Hunters. He always kind of gets dropped off, but, you know, the work they did here was exceptional. And, you know, they went from here, they worked at Cypress and Paso Tiempo and Valley Club, and all those courses are must plays and must sees for anybody that wants to see some of their work. And it's just great that, you know, Meadow Club's their first place, in the connection with the old course at St. Andrews with his design here. It shines a little bit more with as the course opens up.
So what got Meadow Club, for those that don't know, is the first McKenzie design in America. Did he come to America to specifically design Meadow Club, or did he come here for, like, what got him over there?
Well, it was more of his trip to Australia. So it was a stopping off. He met with Perry Maxwell, and they traveled across and stopped in Oklahoma to see his course there. And then he got out here. And at that time, Robert Hunter was, by reading through some of the correspondence, he was more or less acting as an agent for McKenzie, and was trying to get him work while he was traveling through. And, you know, there's other stories, but this is the best documented one. There was some stories about McDonald Smith being involved in the process, but from what I can tell, he was more of a traveling pro at that time. May not have even have been in the area, but Hunter has it in. I've got it in his writing, in correspondence that I found between him and one of our founding members. So it was pretty cool to find that.
So I asked this question to Jim Urbina. If you could have either Robert Hunter, you're building a golf course tomorrow and you can bring him back from time. You could have Robert Hunter or Perry Maxwell as your associate. Which one are you taking?
I know much more about Robert Hunter, and I don't know how much architecture talk we would have, because I would be asking him all about all his socialist tendencies and hanging out with Mark Twain and almost being killed in New York in a bombing where he was supposed to give a talk. But it feels like Perry Maxwell was a little more closer to the, I don't know what I'm trying to say, but more refrained, more religious, I'll say that. I was trying not to go there, but you know, just looking at some of the books that Perry Maxwell was reading, it sounds like I don't know if I would have been, it wouldn't have been as enlightening a conversation with him. But to work, it would be great to work with both. Having just seen Old Town this last year, or almost 2 years now, that is amazing, the work that he was able to do there and the work that Corin Crenshaw did. But
it's kind of similar to the work you guys are doing here.
Yeah, here. Yeah. I mean, the width that they have there, again, here we go. The width on the last couple holes, you know, 17, 18, 9, and whatever the other hole is there. I mean, it's just amazing with that double green coming in and the tee shot up the hill. I mean, I stood out there for way too long. It was just an amazing, I didn't want to leave. It was just amazing there. But Robert Hunter gets it just because of, I've done way more research on Robert Hunter, and he's fascinating.
So most of your research has been centered around California golf.
McKenzie. I try to keep it to California, but if anybody knows, the guys that know me are laughing because I've helped out. What I try to do is I do all my research and then I just keep finding things. And, you know, if I know somebody at the course, I'll send it to them if it's really good. I Chris Tritabaugh, when he was at Northland, I sent him a picture of the 18th green there. And he was like, I've never seen this picture before. This is before so-and-so did this and that. And, you know, I just love to be, I just love to share the information, because my goal is to, if I do go to Northland, it's going to be better because the superintendent there knows a little bit more about the course, and through the club, they can make their golf course better. I want to, as a historian, I want to see more of the history, more of the architecture, and not see all the changes that have been made to the negative. I want to see the changes to the positive. And I feel like the superintendent should be knowledgeable. I agree with Kyle Hegland in his wonderful podcast. Superintendent should know about golf course architecture and understand it and the relevance of whoever designed their golf course. I think it's important.
I got a question. What are a couple restoration projects or a couple courses that have restored, you know, their courses back to the originality of the course that you think have done really well? And then what are a couple that you would really like to see do a complete restoration?
Old Town was amazing. I mean, that was really good. Valley Club with their restoration work and their turf changes with the Bermuda grass. I went out there and played. I didn't even play it. I walked it in February of 2015, and it was amazing, the work that they have done out there. LA Country Club. I'm a little more California centric. Obviously, I don't get out there too far, but Cal Club is wonderful. But you know, to speak to the courses, I would love to see restored. Riviera would be amazing. Crystal Downs. You know, just squeezing out a little bit more McKenzie there would be incredible. But you know, Sharp Park would be amazing. The front nine out there, the original front nine, if anybody's ever looked at it, if they haven't, you should look at it. It's an amazing routing around that the lagoon, the Laguna Salada. Really amazing. You know, just it almost doesn't matter what course, though. I mean, to me, it's widening the fairways, reducing the rough, slowing the greens down, and just getting back to enjoying the game. Anybody, just restoring that golf course to those features, because the green speeds are too fast, the rough is too long, there's too much rough. You know, it just goes, we've gotten so far away from how simple the game can be with trying to make it harder and trying to make it tournament golf. I mean, I understand it from the tournament side, seeing how far they hit the ball and this and that, but we don't need to make it harder for the day-to-day golfers, and we've done a really good job of doing that, and we need people to enjoy the game.
Isn't it way more economical, though, to rebuild a green than just to slow them down? That's a joke. We had a funny conversation about stimp meters earlier today, and how the USGA started manufacturing them and giving them to people, but then they don't. You were saying they don't tell the stimp meter reading of the U.S. Open.
Yeah, I mean, the stimp meter is. I'm a little too infatuated with the stimp meter for a lot of different reasons, but it's just become what it shouldn't have been, is a speed meter. You know, when the USGA when they first rolled it out, they were going to call it the speed meter, and they pulled back on that. And it's a dangerous tool. And, you know, there's people are going to gravitate to it for different reasons. And, you know, I'm just nervous having people out of my golf course or anybody else's golf course trying to understand how to use it. Without any formal training. I mean, you can read the pamphlet, but when you get on that green and you're rolling the ball out there, there's more science to it than it sounds. And we need to understand, golfers need to understand that the faster the greens get, you know, more hole locations are lost, more time they're going to spend on the course if they like to four putt, you know, all the power to them. But I'd rather have more hole locations and more enjoyable rounds and getting around and playing more golf.
It's amazing how many people don't even they don't even come close to actually understanding green speeds. You'll sit there and you guys, the greens are rolling 11 today. And I'm sitting there going like, they're maybe like a nine. Like, people don't understand how fast like a 10 is.
And, you know, no matter who I talk to as a superintendent, there's what I try to do when a member asks me, or a golfer, if they ask me what the green speed is, I'll ask them what they think it is first. And invariably it'll be slower than what the actual number is. And we have a range that we try to hit here so that our members don't have to ask. They know that it's within a range of 10.9 to 11.3. And it's been moving up. Green speed in the United States has been moving up. When they first took readings in 1977-78 with the USGA, the average green speed out of 700 courses tested was 6.5 feet. I'd be very interested, and I'm hoping to do some research with Micah Woods. We're just started to talk about it to try and figure out what the average green speed in the United States is today. I think it would be very interesting to see the numbers.
I think I might start selling signs. You just made me think of it, of, you know, today's stimp meter, and have it just be a permanent number.
No matter what you do, it's always going to be
11.5.
Just every day 11.5, no matter what. It's Zach, from a professional side, like, I remember watching your, like, a Ryder Cup and the British Open or the Open Championship, and hearing that sometimes the slower greens can really mess with the American players more so than the Europeans. Do you ever see that playing abroad versus here?
Yeah, I just think, you know, out there we're so used to putting on really fast greens, and, you know, you kind of stroke your putts to that type of speed. you know, and your whole game's kind of around, you know, your whole game on the green is built around that certain kind of tempo or that style. And then when you get to slower greens and kind of have to change that up to kind of hit putts harder instead of stroke them, yeah, I think it kind of really screws with guys.
So do you think it's more, would challenge players more to have slower greens with pins on more slope or faster greens with pins on less slope?
I think guys would be able to adapt either way. You know, if the PGA Tour played slow greens, it might mess with guys for a couple weeks, but then they'd be able to figure it out. So I think it's kind of the best players in the world out there, so they'd get it.
So Sean, with Mackenzie, what do you feel is the most underappreciated aspect of his design?
That's a good question. I don't think about it like that. probably just his use of the routing, his routings. You know, some people kind of downplay it for certain courses, but you know, one of my favorites is just how simple he does it at Meadow Club, at Valley Club, at Cypress Point, where he uses hills. And you know, the hill on 9 at Cypress, you know, how many greens come into that area, how many greens come into the area here at Meadow Club and at Valley Club. You have all these tees built up on the hills, playing from one hill to the next. And what that really is, you know, there's intimacy there. So that his courses are very intimate until you start adding length. But there's something else there, that it's the economic. There's a word, a couple words I'm missing here. But where he's designing golf courses
with like the idea of like ease of maintenance.
He designed, you know, when he designed Bayside, that course was built within so many months and open. But then also when you have 5 greens in one area, you can go in and mow all those greens and have 5 greens mowed by 2 guys instead of 2 guys walking all over and getting 3 greens mowed. So there was a degree where he was paying attention. And later in his career, you know, Lake Merced just turned up some really cool information where he was offering his services to help improve their greenkeeping work at the course. So, and if you read any later on, he's talking and writing about how greenkeeping has changed over the years. And I mean, you know, the other part is, you know, his connection with Hunter. Everybody is like, it doesn't seem like there should be a connection between those two guys, but you know, Mackenzie, when he traveled to Australia, he wrote an article for an Australian magazine about the United States as a whole from an economy standpoint, you know, what's driving it. So there's so many layers to Mackenzie, as there are with Hunter, that we don't know how deep they went on so many things, but they were very cosmopolitan. I mean, they were a part of so many different things back then. And it would have been just really amazing to sit in on some conversations with those guys.
So you get to sit in. Let's just say you got to ask Mackenzie one question. What would it be?
There's a couple things.
It could be a really complex question too. You know, if you need to have multiple parts.
I mean, it would be. Yeah, I just got a bunch of stuff going in my head.
Give the guy a couple questions. Let him ask a couple questions.
We'll say, like, you know, what are the things that you always wonder about?
Well, okay, it comes. This one's really simple. It's, you know, you got certain architects. They left all the stuff behind, and with him, the golden lamb, or so to speak, of what I want is the routing map for Meadow Club. And there's stories that Jack Fleming had it, and then John Fleming, his son, had it, and then they're gone. And they just disappeared. Somebody was given, the story was they were given to a golf writer. And myself and Bob Beck, we've been trying to work on this. Bob Beck is a noted historian, plays out of Paso Tiempo. If we could find those plans, how cool would that be to find the actual routing map for Meadow Club in his hand or in Paddy Cole's hand or Fleming's or whoever? I don't care. I want to see it. You look at Billy Bell and George Thomas, the work they did, you know, Stanford, Riviera, you know, some of those early courses that they did, they have aerial views of the course right after it opened. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was on their call or what, but I wish we had earlier aerials here. And McKenzie was a proponent of aerials, aerial photography. In the 20s, he was telling municipalities or whatever they call them in England, you know, if you guys really want to plan for growth, you need to take aerial photography of your villages and hamlets and whatever to understand how and where you can grow. I wish people would have taken that advice. We'd all be richer for it with some really early aerial photography.
Yeah, the aerials are cool. I find myself down a rabbit hole all the time, and then you start looking. It just... And then you go out to places and you get, you know, just frustrating to see how narrow some of the places are.
Yeah. Brian Palmer from Shore Acres called me, or he texted me right before we left on our trip over there to BTME and the British Turfgrass Management Exposition. And he's like, Tully, Nassau County's got aerials up from 1926. And I started driving back to the shop, and my cart wasn't going fast enough. So I just parked my cart and started running. And we were on the phone texting back and forth. Like, have you seen Piping Rock? Have you seen Lido? And, you know, we're going back and forth, and it was awesome. Garden City was, it looked like it was under the knife. I mean, it was, to be able to see these courses in 1926 was amazing. And I still need to get back and look at those. But the last thing I needed was to see those right while I was planning my trip and getting ready to go.
One of my buddies came across an aerial of the National and Shinnecock. And Shinnecock's mid under the knife, transitioning from...
What year, can I ask?
30. I have it on my computer.
I will need to see that.
Yeah, I'll show it to you. So it's you know, it's mid under the knife. So it, like half the holes are Rainer, McDonald, half and the Flynn. Holes are Flynn.
Yeah.
It's insane. I mean, these old aerials are just treasures for, and that makes a good point. You know, if you only have a 41 of Meadow as the youngest.
Yeah, or, that's the earliest one.
You went through the Great Depression, you're midst World War II, so that's when really a lot of the loss was.
Yeah, I mean, for us, the Depression didn't really hurt the club as much. I mean, we still had labor, but when World War II came, it was the labor was gone, and then we had in 41 there was a drought. So in the aerial, it looks like the farm circles when you're flying over Oklahoma or something where it's just green. I mean, they just ran sprinkler heads at tees, landing areas, and fairways. And so it's we're probably missing some fairway bunkers here and there in the aerial because it's just brown. You can't really define things. But, hey, it's an aerial. We got 1941, so still trying to track down some other ones, but we'll see.
So I asked this of architects all the time. I ask this question is, what do you wish, you know, the average member understood more about architecture? Like one thing.
It doesn't have to be as hard as most people try to make it. For some, Spyglass. What do we know about Spyglass? It's one of the more challenging, hardest tests of golf you'll find in our area. And that's great. I mean, can we just leave it there and not have to bring it home to our course and have fairways be tightened and trees planted or what have you? Not every course has to be play one way. I mean, obviously I'm going to say we need to widen a lot of fairways on a lot of courses, but we do. You know, that's a fact.
Well, it's like you watch Zach play
if the fairway's 25 yards wide, it doesn't really matter for you that much. It's not like you're going to miss. You don't miss many fairways, regardless of how wide it is.
Yeah, it just depends on the day, I guess.
I mean, if it's 50 yards wide, like, you're probably not going to miss many.
Yeah.
But, like, when it's 20, like Northwoods, you didn't miss any fairways. And it's those are 25, 30-yard wide fairways.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a good couple of days, I guess.
Those hickories don't go offline.
Yeah, dude, you were striping that thing. It's crazy.
I might just play hickories from now on. I'm over the real golf ball. So if you found everything there was to find on Mackenzie, like tomorrow, you had everything, what would be the next project?
I'm kind of already started it in my mind, but it would be a way to connect golf historians together to share information. You know, you start talking with somebody and they're looking into one thing or another. And you know, even though I try to stay to the Bay Area, I've got a lot of stuff from all over the East Coast and even in England and Scotland. I have never been able to draw a line and say I'm going to stop. But to be able to share that information and help other guys that are, or other people that are looking into it, there's a wealth of information, and, you know, you don't know. The connections are so small with early golf stuff. Who was working with whom and what courses they were working at. We're only privy to a very small amount of that information based off of where we're gathering it from newspapers or correspondence in the clubs. I mean, up until a couple of years ago, we didn't even know, Herbert Fowler was mentioned as being out here in the early 20s. Vernon McCann was brought in a year before Mackenzie, almost to the day, to look at the course. And that was very interesting because I've done all my research through newspapers and magazines in the Bay Area here, and there was never a mention of that. I've never seen one mention of that. So it really opened up my eyes to, seeing something like, I could speak to Lake Merced. Lake Merced, I know of three architects that were being interviewed or looked at, and it was Willie Watson, Herbert Fowler, and Willie Locke. And Willie Locke ended up getting the job, which when you think about the other two gentlemen that had been in the business, and I mean, Willie Locke caddied for Herbert Fowler when he was a kid. So for him to get that job, it was a pretty big thing for him. Mm-hmm. But there we have the story, but yet there's, who knows? They may have had somebody else in there.
I guess you would be the perfect person to ask about this. What do you think about the whole Cypress routing? About, some people talk about maybe Seth Rayner routed it. Some, like, other people say no way. What are your thoughts?
Well, it's an open-ended question still. I mean, there's been a lot of talk with the Rayner folks and the Mackenzie people, and I mean, just about anybody that wants to throw their name in the hat. We definitely can see. AD Mills took a photograph of the 16th green in 1925 with a flag on it, and then so that's Rayner doing the routing, and we can definitely say that was the green location that he decided on. And then there's another flag on the rock outcropping just behind the current 18th tee that they were going to build the bridge to. Some people want to call that the Mackenzie Bridge, but it really, it was more of a Rayner Bridge because he was out there.
Rayner man.
He had the flag. Somebody put the flag out there for him. I'm sure he didn't put it out there. But, and there was changes. Robert Hunter Jr., that was one of his... He kind of cut his teeth here with Jack Fleming. The club here didn't want Hunter Jr. to get the work by himself because he was pretty young, to say the least. But he went in there and, he got in trouble for a little bit of the work that they did, but they rerouted a couple of the holes to make room for the 17-mile drive. It'd be very interesting. I mean, you know, you don't get that chance very often to see how two different architects, you know, especially a natural relying on the beauty golf course that, or the beauty of the land with McKenzie and then Rainer, kind of, you know, the whole engineer aspect, but engineering with some reliance on the beauty. You know, Fisher's Island is a good example.
Yeah, those would be two really cool, like, architect maps to kind of look at and compare and say, like, you know, you never know. Maybe, you know, maybe they were both very similar.
So we got a Rainer nut and a McKenzie nut sitting next to each other. I want to know from each of you what your favorite thing about the other architect is. So, Sean, your favorite thing about Rainer, and Zach, your favorite thing about McKenzie?
Lido. The Lido course. You know, just the engineering feat that they went out after. And I just wish he had said more and written more, or had, you know, that's...
That's another treasure trove another that thing. Somebody needs to find, huh?
Yeah. There's not much out there. I mean, I know Tony Pioppi's, he's out there looking and finding some things, but, you know, that would be amazing if his diary would turn up or something. But that's just me dreaming. I'm always dreaming, trying to think of the possibilities. But
yeah, for me, I'm kind of turning into a McKenzie nut. You know, we're on a nice little road trip here. But I mean, it's easy to go with, you know, the bunkering is just like out of control. Not only the way it looks, but, you know, just bunker placement and just how it all ties together, kind of the whole layering aspect of everything is just out of control.
There are so many good ones. I mean, I think I've come to realize the most beautiful bunkers in the U.S. are in California between Thomas, Bell, McKenzie, and Hunter. It's pretty outstanding work.
Yeah, I mean, it's that there's definitely a California feel to it by definition of it being in California, but
literally.
But to get to a point, McKenzie was already starting it and doing some of that work. And if you look at some of his later work prior to coming to California, you can see him kind of putting it together. But one aspect in, you know, the research I've done is how far did it get east? And there was a couple different architects that were actually in Michigan. I'm drawing a blank on their name. But one golf course in particular that's seminal in how the bunkering, the original bunkering, if you look, there's a great picture in Golfdom magazine on the cover in 1930 or 31. And it looks just incredible. But you're looking at it and you're like, is that seminal? And you're like, of course it is. It's got all the palm trees in the background and whatnot. But what was going on to have that happen? Why were those bunkers designed there? That's the question I have. And obviously Dick Wilson did all this stuff they've been changed. And I haven't been there to see the work that Corin Crenshaw has done yet, but it's interesting in that, you know, in the research I've done, I've got Bobby Jones out for the 1929 U.S. Amateur. And just in a short little column, they asked him one word comments about the golf courses he was playing or had played. And it was Pasatiempo, Riviera, L.A. Country Club, San Francisco, Pebble, and Cypress Point. And I'm going to mix them up a little bit for sure. But, you know, Sporty was Riviera. Pebble Beach was... he went a little wordy and he said, not as good as I thought it was going to be, or I was told or something. And, LA Country Club, was Sporty again. I think he used that twice, but the kicker was when he got to Cypress Point, the way he described it kind of set the tone for his thinking, you know, very early on that he was probably going to have McKenzie there for his course. And Cypress Point was very simply a course I wouldn't mind having in my backyard. Yeah. So I'm wondering if the work that Ross did at Seminole had some correlation of him trying to feed off of McKenzie's work and style. But that's just me asking a question, trying to figure out why that style went that direction, because the bunkering is nothing like Ross's bunkering. So why did that happen there? I know that Hunter was out there, and Hunter and Ross were very close with their Pinehurst days. So that's a mystery that I would like to figure out, or, you know, maybe somebody out there is looking for something to research and
somebody might be listening. Yeah. Somebody might know.
Yeah.
So if you could, if there's one, you know, say we're going to say non-living architect that you could have just all of their work they did erased, never, you could remove all of it from the world, which one would it be?
Non-living?
Non-living. We're going to keep it friendly here.
Oh my gosh. Come on. This is the fried egg.
I mean, I would answer in the opposite. One architect that we don't have anything nearly enough of, that we need to know more of, is William Langford. Because I mean, no matter the work that those guys were doing, there's a handful of guys that, you know, weren't up to snuff with the other guys back in the day, but I'd almost rather have their course than some of the guys that are living. Some of their work in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the 90s, that's just a whole different flavor. I like the old school flavor. Mm-hmm. I mean, golden age is golden age to me. But William Langford, after seeing Lasonia and some pictures of his other courses, if it's McKenzie and then it's William Langford for me, pretty quick.
Yeah, Langford is a victim of a lot of bad renovations too, of people that just didn't understand the bold contours and the idea of green that's unpinnable, or, you know, these big slopes and giant scale. I'm lucky. I'm in like Langford Central in Chicago, so I've seen a lot of his stuff, and he is definitely underappreciated over, you know.
Yes.
It's so you want to do some overrated, underrated?
If we're at that point already.
I got one, Hickory's.
Underrated.
What about overrated, underrated Pebble Beach?
It's, for me, it's overrated. And can I answer to
Absolutely.
Why?
Yeah.
Just for me and, you know, Chris Dahlheimer, I have this conversation with him all the time. Just how, and it's not, I mean, I'm not trying to pick on him. I just enjoy talking with him about it. Just the size of the greens. And it's that the shifting baseline, and it's also how the golf course has become defined by how small the greens are. Another golf course is Brookline. Brookline is defined by really small greens. I've got an article from 1923 or something that their greens were huge compared to what they have now. But the landforms have changed with the work that's been done over the years. But being able to look at the old pictures, and, you know, a lot of work's been done at Pebble. But Egan's work in 28 to get it ready for the amateur was awesome. You know, the faux dunes and the width, and bringing all the fairways over closer to to the ocean. I mean, they were moved over. I've got some really cool sketches by a golf pro out of Olympic Club that shows where the old fairways were and where they moved them to. And they were playing it safe for a long time there. But Pebbles, you know, it's a great place, but those greens, I would love to see them bigger, and the fairways too.
Yeah, some of those old pictures that have been popping up on Twitter the last, you know, 2-3 months of, you know, 6, 7, 9, 8, 10, those holes kind of on the coast at Pebble just look out of control. How cool they were!
Yeah, I mean, it's I mean, I've got a couple different, I've got like three or four different write-ups on all the changes that he made. I mean, it's just, Egan, he gets lampooned a little bit for Eugene, you know, with all the work that wasn't so good. But what he did there was really good.
One of Chicago's finest.
Yeah.
Olympian, Exmoor member. Don Holt, shout out Don Holton. He's done a lot of, he's a great historian.
Yeah, yeah. I think Egan is, he was a precursor to Bobby Jones. You know, he took the game by storm and, you know, he was a flogger. I mean, he hit the ball a long ways. He just didn't know where it was going, but he could recover. And I think it was the 04, 05 open, or amateurs that he won. Chicago and somebody else.
He won the Olympics, too.
No, he came in second.
Second in the Olympics. Yeah.
You know what was interesting to hear about what he was mentioning about Pebble kind of before they changed it for the USAM? You know, a lot of those fairways kind of way off the cliffs and stuff kind of reminds me of
Torrey.
Yeah. Sad deal. Gotta use the natural hazards, right?
They're the most intimidating thing you could put on a golf course is an ocean cliff.
Yes.
That's like 500 feet.
Yeah, that's probably like the best hazard and the best way you can intimidate someone to play away from the ideal line, right?
It seems like Torrey Pines, it's like so, it's almost too easy to put a good golf course out there that it's so sad to see what it is with how easy it could be. Unbelievable. What do you think about that?
Well, for me, I played it a couple of years ago now, and the setup was what I was having a hard time with the setup. I mean, the rough was too long. It was set up for you, not for me. And again, you get a lot of people going out there for that. But yeah, I mean, it just felt like there was a lot of potential out there.
So one of the municipalities' big pushbacks on width is always maintenance costs going up. I always say, well, you're probably going to have more rounds to combat that because people are going to get around faster and they're going to play more. Like, what kind of maintenance costs, say you were going from 25 to 40 increase, would you see?
Well, it depends on the area of the country you're in. I mean, if you go back east, their fungicide budget's going to go double. But for us out here, I mean, you know, you guys saw some snow mold on our fairways. We don't really, it's very minimal. We'll have it and we won't treat it. But, you know, it's just another, it's a different mower mowing the grass. As you're saying, the cost will offset itself to some degree by having more people out there to enjoy it and to get them around the course a little quicker because they're going to be able to find their ball or, you know, it's just an easier walk.
You know, if they stayed wide, you wouldn't see car paths inside of bunkers.
That true. That is what, true.
What's your biggest pet peeve?
Just cart use.
Whoops.
I mean,
Zach had a bad cart use today.
No, I don't think it was bad. I think we just needed it. We needed you had the drone in there. It was like, I didn't want to have to carry the camera around. I was doing it more for you, honestly. I didn't want to ride.
I mean, for me, when you get out to play golf, I mean, the whole point is to get out and enjoy being outside, enjoy the camaraderie with your fellow golfers. You get behind the wheel and it's just, you might as well be on the 101, you know, you're turning the radio stations on your phone, texting somebody, you know,
it's true.
Just drop it, you know, get out of the cart and just walk and enjoy, you know, take a caddy or take a four bagger and, you know, put four bags on a cart and have a couple of people walk and just push them a little bit. I've got a member here that I'm always giving him a hard time, but, It's really fun when I see him and he's walking, he's like, I'm over here walking, see me? You know, it's trying to change the culture. And, you know, Cal Club is, you know, probably the embodiment of that culture change. And it's not an easy culture change. I think Thomas Bastis, when he was still there, he tweeted out a picture of just a member event. I don't know if it was a member guest or whatnot, but it was all walking bags. And you just don't see that. When you have an outside event, I mean, it's let's get in the cart and go play golf and drive around. And, you know, for me, it's the experience. No matter how many times I play golf, which I haven't played a lot, just a lot of things going on, raising three girls in the Bay Area, working. I just don't play as much. But when I do, it's going to be walking and with some good company.
It really is amazing how much more enjoyable golf is when you walk. Like, I mean, I even noticed it today. I'm sitting there, you know, texting and looking at Twitter. And all you guys are back there talking. And then I get up to the ball and sit there for like 2 or 3 minutes waiting for everybody, you know, and all you guys are just talking about how cool all the features are, looking at everything. And I'm like, gosh, I should have walked. But like, it's so bad in Utah. There's not one golf course that promotes walking. Like, not one private club, not one public place. It's like cart ball everywhere. Yeah. It sucks.
And it's really easy to promote it. Instead of, you know, somebody comes into the pro shop and, you know, I'm going to play 18 holes. Oh, are you going to walk today? I mean, usually it's the opposite. Are you going to take a cart? I mean, we just need to simply change the conversation. True. And walk.
What kills me is the places that have the cart included in the rate. You know, like our rate's $60 with it comes with a cart. Cart included. It's like, what? Why would you do that?
I think, you know, I got on this conversation with my dad the other day, who is in that side of the business, and he kind of talked about it's that revenue, you know, it's the pro shop, the pros wanting to make a couple extra bucks by getting the carts, you know, the cart money.
Yeah.
And which is sad.
There's the flip side of cart paths and ropes and signs. I mean, especially out here where it's such a beautiful property. And you know, one of the things we're trying to do is eliminate signs and ropes, but there's still, we have outside play on some Mondays, and it's the carts will just end up going anywhere if you don't put the ropes up. I mean, there's new technology with the GPS and all that, but it all costs money. And just walking, it's good for your health. I mean, we have a gentleman here that's in his, I mean, he's 98. I thought he was 95, but I mean, not a big difference there. But he plays 18 holes, and then he'll jump on a cart and play another nine.
Jeez.
So it's good for your health.
So 10 rounds, Northern California. So we're going to say from kind of the Pebble, Cypress, Monterey, North. How are you? You get 10 rounds. How are you splitting them up? You can do multiples at places.
This is an exercise I do occasionally. I kind of keep it to the Bay Area because I don't want to throw Monterey in it. But I would only play Cypress. Are we talking 10 times in 1 year or just?
You get 10 rounds.
10 rounds. I will play Cypress once.
Okay.
And just because when I go out there, it's going to be that moment that I'm there. And if I play it more than once, then I'm taking advantage of it. San Francisco is in there. Meadow Club, Claremont. I guess they'll have to be multiple times, but, you know, Monterey Peninsula, I have yet to see the Dunes course. So I'll throw that in there. I was excited that there was some possibility of it, that they might have gone Rainer with it, but that kind of obviously fell through. You know, Pacific Grove, the back nine, I would play that twice and just skip the front with the houses. But, you know, Presidio is fun for the challenge of the hills and the history of the course with the property, being golf on that property since 1895. I would lose count.
I already lost count.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, Claremont, for me, I would always say 10 rounds of golf just in the Bay Area. And it would be, you know, about six times at Meadow, three times at San Francisco and then one at Claremont. I really like Claremont, the crossing holes, the history. It doesn't have to be long to be fun, and it's challenging. So
I would say one of the cooler things like we learned this week, that wasn't today, was how we learned that the Presidio was the original San Francisco Golf Club, and then they moved to a place.
Inglewood.
Then they moved again.
Ingleside. Yeah.
Then they moved again, and Cal Club bought Ingleside.
The second one.
The second go around, and then found another place and built it. So at one time, that Ingleside was Cal Club and SF.
And it was almost cool. And it was almost Olympic Club.
Dang, that would have been sick.
So Olympic Club was looking at the second course, and they ended up buying the Lakeside property. Golf course, which had just been built, and they made quite a few changes to it. So there was quite a jumble, and it didn't help that Ingleside, the old course and the new course, I mean, they were so close to each other, it makes it a challenge to do some research on it and figure out which course they're actually talking about.
Yeah.
San Francisco was probably one of the courses I did my most research on, because you would look at the course ratings, the top 100s, and Golf Digest would say it was designed, it was a Tilling Aston Open in 1918. And then Golf Week would say it was 1921 or 20. And somebody else would say another date. And I'm like, wow, you would think somebody would have this figured out by now, when it opened and who designed it. And I got interested in the history of it. And for me, I try to identify the architects and the evolution of a golf course and the importance of not sticking to what becomes mythology, which is in some ways rooted in facts, but it gets bigger and bigger to build up the stature of a certain club. And it happens all over the place. It doesn't matter what course it is. But, San Francisco, the first property, 1895, I can't say with accuracy the original architect, but it played over just the first couple holes right there off the clubhouse. All nine holes played over 9, 10, and 18 today. And then they moved due to the use of the property as the training grounds for the military. They moved to the second Ingleside course, and I believe I have the architect of the course, but I need to get another verification. But it was John Clark, who had two sons that would go on to be golf pros. But and then they moved and opened up the current course in February of 1918, and it was designed by three members. So, and it kind of got lampooned in the same way that Pebble Beach did when it first opened. There was quite a bit of criticism over the quality of the links, and some changes were made even before Tillinghast was there, to the point that, what we see on the front nine was drastically changed before Tillinghast even made changes to the course. And then Tillinghast was brought in the end of 1919 and 20, and he had a plan drawn up. And this is the same time Herbert Fowler was in the area. So it's really interesting, the dichotomy of, and Rayner was there in 1918. He actually stayed at the clubhouse at San Francisco.
I knew I felt it.
And have you guys seen, did you guys play Olympic Club already?
We played the Cliffs course.
Okay. Did you see the routing map? Have you seen his routing map for Rainer's routing map?
Someone posted it. I've seen it a little bit, but we didn't look at it the other day.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Is it in there?
Yeah, it's in there.
We missed the boat there. Would you say, I got one more overrated, underrated. San Francisco Golf Club, overrated, underrated.
Tricky one.
It's
or properly rated.
Properly rated. I feel I'm middle of the road on that one. I feel like there's, I know it more from a historical standpoint. I love, you know, they've added some bunkers that, you know, Tillinghast had taken out later on. Again, for me, the greens feel like they need to be a little bigger. The fairway width is awesome out there. My favorite tee shot is number one. I mean,
it's mega width.
Mega width. It's, you know, it's close second to St. Andrews on width. I haven't measured it, but it can't be wider than that. But it's a special place.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, with, you know, you're drawing a fine line on honoring all the work that's been done out there, and but at the same time, you're nervous. And are we going to make it better, or are we compromising something? And you don't want to compromise anything, especially at San Francisco Golf Club. It's that special of a place. When you walk out there, it just gives me the chills. On most days, it does give you the chills, but depending on how much fog's there. But I think it's right where it needs to be. And, you know, they're still making changes to it. The fourth hole, they've made some adjustments to it. The reef hole, you know, they got, yeah. I mean, I'm glad they went back to the original routing, where the Harold Sampson routing got changed back 13, 14, and 15. That's just me being a historian, but,
Sampson really loved the dog leg, the tree line dog leg, huh?
He worked those pretty hard.
But shout out to the Dokito for bringing it back, right?
I think Tom Doak did the work, yeah, right?
I think so, yeah.
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 Good job.
That little green bunkering there is phenomenal, I think. It's and the front line, front nine topography is pretty unbelievable.
I definitely, for me, the front nine is great out there. Just the variety of shots, and, you know, the 12th is another great hole out there. I love the tee shot and the challenge of getting the second shot figured out.
Would you go front nine SF, back nine PASA if you could put two Bay Area nines together?
Yeah.
Can't wait to see PASA tomorrow.
Yeah, it's gonna be good. I guess the last overrated, underrated will be yardage finder, guns and finders,
range finders.
Overrated. I'm kind of from. I'm just old school. I just will stand up and I'm gonna just look at it and gauge it. And I think it for, you know, some of the stuff that we have out here and some of the other courses, McKenzie courses, where he's visually challenging you, to know the yardage kind of defeats some of that. But, you know, everybody wants every advantage they can get. And that seems to be one that has struck a chord with people, either on their watch or whatever device they want to use, the sprinkler head or what have you. And from a pace of play standpoint, I think there's some benefit to it, but we're not addressing the other benefits, which we've already talked about, having, you know, more width in the fairways and less rough and, you know, green speed. I just keep harping on those because I think those are really important. And we get back to those simple things. We, you know, the time that we gain from using a yardage finder it's not a big deal. It's the other things that we need to do to make golf more enjoyable. We don't need it to have we don't need 12-inch holes, and we don't need to play foot golf. You know, they can if they want, but we just need to get back to what really, you know, the biggest boom in golf was the 20s. I don't fall into the idea that Tiger Woods was all, he did a great thing for golf, but I think he kind of ushered in a more consumer-based golf in thought and, you know, cart golf and, you know, what shoes am I going to wear?
Tiger proofing.
And tiger proofing.
You know, I mean, me and Andy talk about it a little bit. I think they got the whole Tiger proofing thing so wrong. You know, it's so like he's such a long hitter, and he was hitting it by everybody, and he was a power player, and so they wanted to push the tees further back, and they wanted to make the bunkers more in play for, you know, longer hitters. But it's like all they should have done to Tiger proof courses is like make courses shorter and wider, and the exact opposite.
Yeah, I mean, we just keep seeing the yardage go up, and you know, one of the things I've looked at is U.S. Opens and how they've changed. The first course at 7,000 yards was in 1937 at Oakland Hills, and it would be 60 years before they got to 7,200 yards, and then all of a sudden, in the last 21 years or so, what did we hit? 7,800.
We're pushing 8,000.
So,
right?
the golf it's changed that dramatically in such a short period of time, and they use these numbers where they talk about the average yardage has gone up 0.2 yards on certain tours and gone down on the others by 0.2. If you do the math, I mean, you should add about 3 yards in the last 15 or so years. I think it's 14 years since Shinnecock hosted the last U.S. Open. They added 453, if I remember the number right, 450-ish yards to a golf course. They've added a par 4.
Yeah, it's long.
It's a lot more.
I played there last year from the U.S. Open tees, and it's definitely a big boy course, so yeah. It'll be interesting to see. It is awesome, though. That place is sick.
Yeah, and, you know, the Coren Crenshaw did the work leading up to it, and they've widened the fairways.
A lot. Mega width.
And now they've kind of narrowed them down a little bit. I mean, as much as the USGA wants to say, this is still wider than the previous U.S. Open, they still send a negative connotation by narrowing it. They're still saying there's an issue with it being wide. And it's just, for me, it's a hang-up that a lot of people have. Just this notion that golf has to be hard or a challenge, or it can't be easier because we cut down these trees. We don't want to make the golf course easier. I mean, it's... Show me the scores.
The other thing is, like, everybody's like, well, this era is so much more talented, so much better players. Like, they're, you know, technology's better. Like, the game's not the same as it used to be, but we still have to hold on to the same score as, like, the sacred number. Like, oh, this is the, if it's not close to par, it's not a real U.S. Open. It's like, well, the game has changed dramatically. So, like, why would the par still be the same if everybody's better and technology's better?
Yeah. I mean, even you're just talking about from the player standpoint.
Yeah.
I mean, you need to talk about what we're doing as superintendents.
Yeah.
And the technology that we bring to the game with our moisture meters, our new products of wetting agents. And I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we're doing that has driven some of this as well. And so technology as a whole has really taken the game and pushed it in the wrong direction. And having just come back from the UK and Ireland and seeing some amazing golf courses and learning and seeing what they do over there, I mean, I met with, did a course tour with Eamon, the links manager there at Royal County Down, and just listening to what they don't do over there. And they still provide wonderful course conditions, and, we can be our own worst enemy, and we have a lot of tools to do a lot of things, but at some point the game's going to, we're already up against it with yardage and all these other things. But at the same time, the cost of maintaining courses, the dues that our members see, environmental concerns. I mean, there's all these, and labor. I mean, labor, if you talk to anybody in our industry, labor is, we're running into robot mowers now. I mean, we're out there trying to figure out how can we maintain greens and do all this work, but with a labor force that's reducing. And in our association, our golf course superintendents of Northern California, we're trying to figure out how we can get interns to come out and work at some of our better courses. And it's a challenge. I mean, the job market out there, it's not what it used to be. And so we're trying to get our story out there and try to get some young people interested in our industry. And it's, you know, we're working with the National Golf Course Superintendents Association, you know, trying to get that out there and go to job fairs at high schools and let people know that this is a viable job with a lot of character building, and you can take care of your family stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty cool gig to just get to hang out on the golf course every day too.
It's not bad.
Yes,
the early mornings, sunrises, sunsets. I mean, it's just. I don't know where I'd be if I wasn't doing this work.
What's better light, morning light or night light, or like a sunset light for pictures? What do you think?
For my personal schedule, the morning light is better. But I love being up here late in the afternoons. The colors are, it just looks better. Looks drier, I guess. Doesn't have as much luster when you have the dew and stuff.
Which of your peers has the best Instagram feed? Like, who's got the best photos of all the supers?
I literally just got on and started using Instagram. When you have 6 Twitter feeds, it's hard to not be anywhere else. But
Tully's got burners. I mean, burners.
But I mean, I'm, you know, Clyde Johnson. Is that right, Clyde? Yeah. I really, he's, well, you know, him, Clyde, Brian Palmer, and Scott Bavalco, they just wrapped up yesterday their trip that we were on together with TurfNet over in the UK. And they hung out late, and they were taking some amazing pictures of the golf that they were playing. They just need to keep doing that when they get home so we can see what they're doing at their courses.
Scott Vincent. From Onwansia Club takes unbelievable photos. He's like a real pro photographer.
A pro's pro.
Pro's pro.
I'm working on it. I mean, you just see different things. And we're superintendents. We know where the sun's coming up. We know where it's going down. We know which trees we don't want to have in the picture because we might be taking it out or which path. Let's take a picture of this tree before we take it out so we can show what it looked like before and after.
Just get that Photoshop game down where you can just get them all out of there.
Well, that's, what is it? Google Earth. Before they changed you, because now it's free, right? If you use one or the other, I can't remember which one, it'll flatten. If you go to Street View on the golf course, it takes out all the trees, but it keeps the elevations. So I found that out late one night, and I was up for a couple hours, and I would just hit a tee shot, stand in the fairway on one, and just spin myself around, go to the green and spin myself around. And I did all 18 holes just looking for things that I don't normally see because of trees. And I went to different golf courses all around the area. And I mean, on my Google Earth, I've got all the maps that I put on, you know, all the different, things we do for management of grubs and Bermuda grass and all that. And then I have a section where it's just golf courses I want to visit. And I just sit there and I'll study them. And, you know, I'm out there. I've got, with the new Google Earth, now that's free, I can measure the fairway widths and to verify how things are going and, you know, just see where we're at and be able to, you know, Shinnecock, what I love is to be able to go in and, because I was trying to figure out what the yardage was to add to my study of yardages. And I would go to 2016-17, find out where the tees are, and then switch back to 2004 to see where they are in relation to what the tees used to be. And it's really fun to study and see how they did it, or, you know, it in some cases, it's a lot of work. They cut trees down and moved, I think it's on 2 or 3, maybe it's 2. You know, the tee moves over, gets closer over to to national a little bit. And, you know, again, the rhythm of a golf course for me is walking. You know, McKenzie had it right. You know, he did talk about elasticity in his golf courses, but he didn't build in for how far the ball is going today. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what was it? Baltrazol. They were talking about, oh, it's great. You know, they didn't have to add any yardage to the golf course for this year's PGA. And it's, I'm sitting there going, well, do they have any room to add yardage? And they really didn't. And at some point, you know, that's a long course, but we're going to start. We've already lost how many courses?
There's a lot of long walks. Yeah, it's, from the green to the tee.
And then, you know,
yeah, I played the PGA there. It's a big course. It's hard.
Big ballpark.
It's just a lot of walking. I mean, in golf now, with the guys hitting the ball further, it slows play down if you hit the ball as far as you do, because you have to walk even further to get to the ball. It takes longer to walk that distance if it's another 30, 40 yards. So there's a factor there. So that's why, I mean, 5-hour rounds.
They're taking a long time right now.
Yeah.
Not good.
4 hours and 10 seconds over a shot.
4 minutes and 10 seconds.
4 minutes. No, man, 4 hours. Felt like that.
Jeez.
It can.
Yeah. How can people find Sean Tully?
Well, I got the one Twitter handle that I would point them to. Couple of them, I try to stay under the radar, and I think only a couple of people know those.
Burners.
Yes, burners.
He's just gonna come out of the weeds with one of them one day.
The one is that my main Twitter feed is at Toll Fescue. And I've had Toll Fescue as my first email address back in school, trying to figure out something. Somebody was just leaned over and he said, Toll Fescue is your email address. And I was like, that's good. And I've just kept it with everything. Mm-hmm. But, that's mostly golf course architecture and just talking about golf and, you know, anything that really gets me going. But, I post for Meadow Club, and our association for golf course superintendents, and then the other burners I won't talk about.
Next podcast.
Yeah.
Just about the burners.
Yeah.
So thanks for coming on. Awesome day today. And, yeah, everybody follow Sean and start walking off yardage fairway widths.
Please do. Thank you very much. It was great to finally have you out here and do this podcast. I know we've tried to do it quite a few times.
Yeah. Well, hopefully the first of many. So, yeah. Thanks, Zach.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.